Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is season two. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I'm welcoming back my three fellow advocates, scholars, colleagues, and disruptors to talk about current disruptions in women's sport. Doctors Nancy Lowe, Ann Peguerrero, and Katie LaBelle. If you don't know about our disruptors segment, it is a campaign and a movement that highlights disruptions to the normative model of sport, a model created by and for men that typically privileges men. Disruptors draws attention to the people, organizations, and events that disrupt the status quo. So welcome, colleagues, and let's hear what you have for current disruptions in women's sport. Who wants to kick us off?
All right, I'll start. I mean, it's not sport, but I don't know how we couldn't talk about Kamala Harris and the victory on the weekend, just because I think there's a whole story there around, you know, representation matters, and we've seen that in sport over and over again. So I think she's an interesting way to start our conversation about how women are disrupting in different spaces. And I think that maybe Katie will want to talk a little bit about, I think she's going to disrupt the shoe market significantly with her Chuck Taylors and Converse. So I think she's got some interesting things. Maybe we could play off a little bit about the win and the role we've seen sort of women's sports play in all of this.
Yeah, I think that I completely agree with you, Dr. Peguerrero, is that having a woman and a woman of color, a biracial woman of color in a position of power in U.S. politics matters greatly, whether it's sport or not. But she also, when she found out that they had won, she was out running. And that video of her on the phone with Joe Biden stopping her run, sweaty, you know, not camera ready, completely authentic, really, I think, was symbolic of active women in positions of power.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Nicole. I saw that also, so incredibly symbolic, and was really just joyful, honestly, to identify with her in that way, to see her out on a run. There's so many of us that can just really identify with that. And knowing that that's still part of her stress reduction life cycle is incredibly important. I wanted to kind of add into that a little bit on the political space, but more the impact of the WNBA's consistent social activism and how that race in particular in Georgia is still undecided. And, you know, there's still WNBA players that are using their voice to continue to advocate for Warnock. And this is, of course, in contrast to a WNBA owner who came out against Black Lives Matter and the whole social justice movement. So the political space, I think, is quite interesting right now, and how women's sport and women athletes are inserting themselves into that space.
Let's, for our listeners maybe not familiar with the Senate race in Georgia, or for those around the globe who might not be following our U.S. politics so closely, although I have had colleagues around the world reaching out to me, including what I fondly call my emotional support Canadians. I love that, to lend support. But there's two Senate races in Georgia. One is Kelly Loeffler running against Reverend Warnock, and it's really close. And many credit the advocacy and activism efforts of the WNBA for making that close. And now both Senate races are going into a runoff January 5th. So the balance of our U.S. Senate is really at stake here, and we should probably credit the WNBA for that.
Exactly. Yeah, well said. Go ahead, Katie.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's not, it shouldn't be left out too. There were WNBA players that were working as poll workers. I mean, they got down to the nitty gritty. They were so inspirational. And I think to your point, I mean, such a driving force to get out the vote and just get people excited and to know about the implications of a Senate race, even, you know, some of those down ballot races, they're not as covered, the awareness around them isn't as great. And the WNBA strategically picked a cause, they threw everything they had into it, and they made a difference, potentially to the entire country. So that was just such a cool thing to watch, and how inspiring for the next generation to see that they can actually be part of change. And I just add to that, as the mom of a three-year-old, being able to have that conversation about what it meant for their, we went over and kind of broke it down into three simple things. Joe Biden had won, which was the thing she was most excited about. But then that Kamala was the first woman vice president in the history of America. I mean, that was such a joy to have that conversation with her, and to not show Kamala in a, you know, trying to be in the cast or the mold of a male leader, but so authentically just being herself and being her own leader. I think that's such an incredible lesson. And I was thrilled to be able to have those conversations with my daughter. And I know that parents maybe around the globe got to have a little breath of fresh air and be able to have some of those conversations with their kids as well. It was amazing.
So when you just going back to the WNBA for a minute too, because 538, Nate Silver's blog put out some interesting data around political donations by major sports owners of major sports teams. And so if you break out the WNBA owners and where they've given their money in the 2016 and the 2020 campaigns, interestingly, maybe not surprisingly, the Atlanta Dream team was the largest in political donations, and all pretty much Republican. So just about $800,000, $900,000, with a little bit to a bipartisan, but the rest of it went Republican. And then, you know, converse to them would be the Chicago Sky, who pretty much put out $750,000, almost all to the Democratic Party. So we see in there some interesting juxtapositions from these owners versus their athletes, right? And the activities that they've done. Other teams that did really well, like Indiana Fever, spent mostly donations to the Democrats. Sparks the same way. Maybe not so happy for you though, Nicole. The Lynx were all Republican. Small amounts, not a big amount of donations from them, like under 250, I'd say probably about 175,000, but all to Republicans in the races. So I think this is something that's going to be interesting going forward with the work of these women and their social justice, and then this you know, conflict they're going to have with some of their owner groups as their employers, and seeing what happens from that. So that was some interesting, if we talk about letting the data tell the story. The teams where we saw a lot of activism, leaving the Atlanta Dream out, because we know their problems with Senator Loeffler, but the rest of them, like, there was some that were in congruency with their athletes, and others that are probably going to be thinking about some hard conversations with those athletes going forward, I think.
You know, what's interesting about this is we typically, our rhetoric around sport is that sport is a unifier. We all, from different backgrounds, we come together and we love sport, we watch sport, we play sport, we're on teams with people that are different from us. And this really challenges that rhetoric, is sport as a unifier, because you've got the people, some people, not all, in positions of power that have very different political viewpoints than the labor that they employ, which is predominantly women of color in the WNBA. And I don't think that should go unnoticed. It's like this idea of white owners, managers, and coaches, because what we found out a couple of weeks ago in the Tucker Center Distinguished Lecture was, I think Dr. Neff Walker pointed out, there are no Black head female coaches in the WNBA, which I should know that, and I didn't, and I was shocked. But you have predominantly white men and women in positions of power, and a predominantly Black labor force that's in opposition. This will be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. I think this is one of the first times I've seen this data broken out. I was looking for this data. And when, thank God, sometimes Nate Silver does the right thing with 538. He was wrong on the polls, but he was given this data. And so we get
polls
it all
are
from
dead. They're irrelevant. I'm calling it right here on Tucker Center Talks. You heard it. Polls are irrelevant and dead.
I think I would agree. I think most of the people in the US would agree too. But this was good information to understand, right? Because we think that we do think, like you said, Nicole, that sports is this great unifying thing and that people believe in sport and its power for good. And yet it's still a business. And so the people owning these teams, and I know we try to shift and call them governors, but they're still very much owners and employers of this very diverse workforce in most of the sports, and yet have very conflicting views with that workforce. You know, it could maybe explain why sometimes the negotiations of the contracts are so hard, and why until the most recent contract with the WNBA Players Association, there wasn't maternity leaves and benefits like that, because you've got, again, a predominantly white male-owned set of organizations who don't understand, and then also have political views that are, you know, in opposition of their workforce. So you're right. I think the next 4 years will be interesting.
I would just add to that too. I think that the WNBA has shown that they can brand themselves in a different way than men's sport. They're no longer like they don't have to exist in the shadow of the NBA and do things the way the W or the other leagues, other sports organizations have done to build value. And they just build so much value around this social justice movement. It's hard to even separate the basketball from the social justice in some respects for the general public. Of course, that's maybe why they know the WNBA. And so I think that disruption will be really interesting to watch as it goes forward too, because that's a big change in how women's sports have existed to date. And that could be a game changer.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Katie. And I think of, you know, this administration is a game changer too. Thinking about some of the tweets that we saw and thinking about prior to the election being called, that President Biden had sent out his tweet supporting Megan Rapinoe and Sue Bird in their announcement that they were going to get married. And so, you know, then you saw some interesting tweets coming out from the players, in, of course, in support of Biden now that he's won, one including the fact that Megan Rapinoe is happy to go to the White House now. And as we all know, she was not happy to go to the White House and not invited when the former president was still in the White House. So it is a very interesting level of visibility, I think, for women's sport with this new administration and this shift that will only be enhanced because of Kamala as well. And, you know, in particular, as you're saying, like the labor force that is the predominant group within the WNBA has, you know, every reason to celebrate Kamala even more than the rest of us, you know, having a woman in the White House, but also having a woman of color in the White House. So I think that visibility is something we're definitely going to see very different now with this new administration.
So Anne referenced it earlier, Katie, that you're our merch expert, and we who follow Kamala know she has an amazing shoe game and has gotten a lot of street cred and visibility because of her amazing sense of style, including her shoes. So what do you think about this? How is this going to disrupt the sneaker market, if you will?
Yeah, I think it'll be so interesting to see how this unfolds, because one of the things as the campaign was going on, I thought it was so interesting. They talked a little bit about sneakers, but if you remember the Hillary Clinton campaign, and it was always about what she was wearing or what she was doing. And it was so, I mean, the commentary around her was so personalized and you know, the talking about the outfit instead of the substance of what she was saying. And with Kamala, she's built on that. We didn't hear a lot of conversation around what she was wearing. It was much more focused on what she was saying, which that in and of itself is a disruption. Now, moving forward, she's normalizing being able to wear running shoes instead of having, you know, 4-inch heels on to go to an event.
Can we hear a clap for that, please?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, that's a huge deal. She's normalized it and it's being celebrated. There's just a time, I mean, even 4 years ago, I don't think that would have flown. And so The merchandising opportunities around that, we already know the athleisure market in general is up about 6 to 7% compared to other traditional retail. So this athleisure wave that's been ushered around, I mean, it's been ushered in somewhat to do to the fact that we're all home. But I think that this builds on it and it makes it okay. It makes it even cool to be able to embrace this kind of style. And again, it's so important to note that this is her style, and she's not trying to dress in the way that we've traditionally seen leaders. And that, for me, that representation and normalization of that is really big.
Anne?
So let me toss it over to you then, Dr. Liu. Let's talk about sponsorship opportunities. So if this market's growing and we're going to start seeing a change into like what's acceptable or normalized for women to wear, to work, and in these situations, what kind of opportunity do you think this opens up for women athletes and these companies to work together to, you know, I'm thinking of the on-court, off-court look, but keeping the athlete as centered in the athletic leisure world. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And I was thinking as Katie was talking about the images we saw of Diana Taurasi and all the shoes that she wore over the season, that of course none of them were hers, right? And I just can't help but think, like, as was it Vice President-elect Harris is wearing her sneakers, and this kind of awareness is being generated that it perhaps will maybe finally move the envelope on someone like a Taurasi. You know, not that it will be Taurasi, because I think she's kind of near the end of her time, but I would hope that it would maybe move the needle for an Asia Wilson or somebody who, you know, actually has everything it takes from a sponsorship standpoint to be extremely successful, more in the endorsement space, right? But I think it's interesting, and to ask that question, because one of the other things that happened during the time between we had our last disruptors was the ESPNW summit. And I paid particular attention to what the sponsorship panel had to say there. And very interestingly, the woman who's now working for Budweiser was talking about how Budweiser doesn't need visibility anymore. They don't need brand recognition anymore, right? And these are what sponsorship is all about. And so they're moving to more of a supporter type of labeling as to what they're doing. And in that, they have, in fact, shifted their mindset, and they are talking about reinventing their role and leading from the heart instead of from the data, which, of course, that's a contradiction to what Dr. Lavoie advocates. But nonetheless, you know, if you're Budweiser and you're pouring tons of money into sport all the time, which we know they are, I think that means their mindset is going to be expanding to thinking about how do we resonate with women and how do we resonate through women's sport, right? And I like to think of those non-traditional categories, Dr. Peguero, because I think, unfortunately, what happens is, you know, we start to see the beauty brands, right? We start to see the fashion brands. We start to see those things come forward. I think athleisure is fantastic. And absolutely, if I was Athleta or any of these, you know, companies in that space, I would be reaching out to women athletes. But I want to see the financial services. I want to see the insurance companies. I'm so tired of seeing State Farm's commercials with NBA players consistently. I want to see a WNBA player, right? And I know I've talked about this before. Insurance companies make me crazy because they're all these stereotypical males, with the exception of Flo and Progressive. But, you know, I want to see those big ticket sponsors that have deep pockets investing in women's sport. That's when I'll feel like we're really starting to see the needle shift.
So this is maybe a segue. A couple of weeks ago, again, we haven't had the chance to talk about it since we last met, but Secret actually committed $1 million to the PWHPA Dream Gap Tour a few weeks ago, or I guess a couple of weeks ago now. And it's the largest corporate commitment ever made to a professional women's hockey in North America, at least. So that's an example of another category kind of stepping up and making that commitment, making that investment to, in this case, women's hockey. But I think you're right. I think we'll definitely start to see more of that, because we're marketing not necessarily to the demographic, but to the mindsets. And I think that shift to thinking maybe more about some of the psychographics in the market and how that's changing and evolving is going to maybe by necessity have to change the model that we're used to in sports sponsorship.
Yeah, and to add to that one, the other really important piece, because sponsorship, as we all know, is driven by exposure, right? Like, what exposure can you get? How big is your fan base, your audience, et cetera? And one of the other key pieces that came out of that sponsorship group for ESPNW was Google talking about the fact that they are working on discoverability for women's sport. So they've recognized that this is, you know, that there is an audience out there. There are a lot of folks, as we've talked about, who follow women's sport very religiously and have mastered the art of discovering them. But if somebody like Google comes to the table and says, we're going to work on making discoverability much more, you know, accessible for a wider range, I think that has tremendous potential for opening up sponsorship in a way that, you know, we just haven't ever seen before. Because basically that's disrupting the model, right? That's taking the media piece out, as far as like, we have to have the traditional media making us aware of what's going on. Instead, it's just saying, we're going to enhance discoverability and kind of go direct, right, from product to consumer.
Dr. Lowe, for those of our listeners that don't know what discoverability is, can you break it down 101?
I'd rather have Anne do that. She's the expert on social media.
Oh, great.
Do you want to play rock, paper, scissors here, ladies?
Apparently we are. So, I mean, so what I take that to mean is that, you know, Google has a big role in our world. Who hasn't Googled everything all day, right? And it's about how the algorithms and the searches work, and whether or not when I Google for, you know, Serena Williams, what do I get? What pictures do I get of her? What links do I get of her? And which ones rise to the top, as well as being able to find, if I Googled best tennis player in the world, would I just get Roger Federer, or would I get Serena Williams in that search? And so those are the types of things that Google, I think, can help with, because they can fix their algorithms and their search terms to allow women athletes to appear in those searches. And then you're discoverable. You're then getting into the mindset of people who aren't watching sport, or, you know, they're just Googling something and they come up, right? So it's about just being able to find them. But also, when I Google Serena Williams, hopefully she comes up for what she does versus dressed on a red carpet somewhere as the top hit, right?
Oh, I wouldn't hold your breath on that one.
Oh, I know, but I think Google's going to try to do. At least that sounds okay. A bit like what their commitment is to make them both discoverable, but also hopefully, you know, see them as athletes, because their algorithms and their search and all the social media platforms all play a role in this, right? But we need to think about who programs those. The people who program algorithms are predominantly young white males and for these companies. And so they're explicit or implicit bias are part of the algorithm problem. Maybe Google's starting to recognize that.
That's really interesting. So as we wrap up this version of Disruptors, let's do a quick more whip around. What's your last thought on building on what we've talked about, or other disruptions we didn't get to talk about today? There's so much to talk about and we haven't talked for a while. So Katie, why don't you start us off? Last thought of disruptions.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'll just give a shout out. I guess we were all watching ESPNW, which is a little shout out for them. But one of the things that stood out for me was they were talking about the Angel City Football Club. And I think just to highlight the disruption of their leadership team now has over 50 owners and investors. They're changing the playbook around women's sport. And I just think it's such an interesting example. They're not building their club around what, you know, and adapting to a man's world. They're building it to meet the demand for sport that no one else is meeting. And I think that's such a cool thing and such an important disruption. Demand doesn't necessarily dictate business, but Angel City is really aiming to show how it can be done differently and how it can be done for a profit.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting about that is women in other markets with other leagues are taking notice that, hey, oh, we can do this too. So I think that is going to be a major disruption moving forward. Dr. Lowe, what do you have for a final thought?
I'm going to go on a tangent here, but I'm sticking with, again, a little bit of something that came out of the ESPNW Summit, which is Abby Wambach's book, The Wolf Pack. And the reason that I'm mentioning it is because it's a old rules, new rules approach. And I like the lessons that she's putting forward, and in particular, the fact that she's putting them forward for girls. So she's taking her message and trying to teach young women and girls really how to own their power and how to lead using soccer as the venue. And so I think it's an exciting time to think about these kinds of messages that girls are getting and the visibility that's growing for them to see their role models and to see what women can do as athletes. And now, of course, in leading, you know, the greatest country in the world, we can argue about that, but, you know, it just got a lot better over the weekend. So,
okay, Dr. Peguero, final thoughts.
I'm going to go with wasn't positively received everywhere, but I think it certainly was heard around the world in sport. I would go with Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe's proposal. I mean, the simpleness that they chose to put the picture out, the fact that they're celebrating themselves as a couple and their love, and that most organizations and outlets put a very positive story out about around it. So I think, you know, to me, that's a disruption because we haven't seen a lot of that. Even though we think that women's sport is more accepting, it's been a while before we've been able to see two individuals and the most, you know, top of both their sports put this forward. So I think that's a real positive disruption.
And my final disruption will be on the social media space, as I really like this. I don't even know if it's a campaign, but it's people transposing pictures of where it started and where I'm going. And there's been so many pictures that are sport related and that lead to women in leadership positions. And I really think that they're that visual representation of us as little girls in our gear and our athletic little selves and how it's going now has been a real powerful reminder to me that sport participation and being physically active as a child, as a girl, does matter and does lead to, we know from the data, better psychosocial health, leadership, academic, and success in the business world outcomes. So I really love that disruption of here's where I started, here's how it's going. So thank you all for joining Tucker Center Talks for another segment of Disruptors. And we would love you to join us in hashtagging Disruptors, H-E-R-S, by posting disruptions in sport that challenge the normative male-driven, male-dominated model. So as we conclude Tucker Center Talks, I'd love to hear from you. So tweet me at Dr. Sports Psych or at Tucker Center. Check our website out at tuckercenter.org. Follow us on Facebook or Instagram. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wisports.com. Look for Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for this episode of Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.